This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Art of War by Sun Tzu, translated by Thomas Cleary, read by Lloyd James.
Translator's Preface. The Art of War, compiled well over 2,000 years ago by a mysterious Chinese warrior philosopher, is still perhaps the most prestigious and influential book of strategy in the world today. As eagerly studied in Asia by modern politicians and executives as it has been by military leaders and strategists for the last 2 millennia and more. In Japan, which was transformed directly from a feudal culture into a corporate culture virtually overnight, contemporary students of the art of war have applied the strategy of this ancient classic to modern politics and business with similar alacrity. Indeed, some see in the successes of post-war Japan an illustration of Sun Tzu's dictum of the classic, "To win without fighting is best." As a study of the anatomy of organizations in conflict, the art of war applies to competition and conflict in general, on every level from the interpersonal to the international. Its aim is invincibility, victory without battle, and unassailable strength through understanding of the physics, politics, and psychology of conflict. This translation of The Art of War presents the classic from the point of view of its background in the great spiritual tradition of Taoism. What is perhaps most characteristically Taoist about The Art of War in such a way as to recommend itself to the modern day is the manner in which power is continually tempered by a profound undercurrent of humanism. The Art of War is thus not only a book of war, but also of peace. Above all, a tool for understanding the very roots of conflict and resolution.
Translator's Introduction.
According to an old story, a lord of ancient China once asked his physician, a member of a family of healers, which of them was the most skilled in the art. The physician, whose reputation was such that his name became synonymous with medical science in China, replied, "My eldest brother sees the spirit of sickness and removes it before it takes shape, so his name does not get out of the house. My elder brother cures sickness when it is still extremely minute, so his name does not get out of the neighborhood. As for me, I puncture veins, prescribe potions, and massage skin, so from time to time my name gets out and is heard among the lords." Among the tales of ancient China, none captures more beautifully than this the essence of the art of war, the premier classic of the science of strategy in conflict. The healing arts and the martial arts may be a world apart in ordinary usage, but they are parallel in several senses. In recognizing, as the story says, that the less needed the better, in the sense that both involve strategy in dealing with disharmony, and in the sense that in both, knowledge of the problem is key to the solution. As in the story of the ancient healers, in Sun Tzu's philosophy, the peak efficiency of knowledge and strategy is to make conflict altogether unnecessary. And, like the story of the healers, Sun Tzu explains there are all grades of martial arts. The superior militarist foils enemies' plots. Next best is to ruin their alliances. Next after that is to attack their armed forces. Worst is to besiege their cities. This ideal strategy whereupon one could win without fighting, accomplish the most by doing the least, bears the characteristic stamp of Taoism, the ancient tradition of knowledge that fostered both the healing arts and the martial arts in China. The ancient Taoist masters showed how the man of aggressive violence appears to be ruthless, but is really an emotionalist. Then they slay the emotionalist with real ruthlessness, before revealing the spontaneous nature of free humanity. Real ruthlessness, the coldness of complete objectivity, always includes oneself in its cutting assessment of the real situation. This is the ruthlessness of Lao Tzu when he says in the Tao Te Ching that the universe is inhumane, and the sage sees people as being like the straw dogs used for ritual sacrifices. Zhuang Tzu, another ancient Taoist master, also gives numerous dramatic illustrations of ruthlessness toward oneself as an exercise in perspective designed to lead to cessation of internal and external conflict. This inhumanity is not used by the original philosophers as a justification for quasi-ruthless, possessive aggression, but as a meditation on the ultimate meaninglessness of the greed and possessiveness that underlie aggression. In India, Buddhist aspirants used to visit burning grounds and watch the corpses of those whose families couldn't afford a cremation rot away. This they did to terrify the greed and possessiveness out of themselves. After that, they turned their minds toward thoughts of ideal individuals and ideal societies. Similarly, Master Sun has his readers dwell on the ravages of war, from its incipient phases of treachery and alienation to its extreme forms of incendiary attack and siege, viewed as a sort of mass cannibalism of human and natural resources. With this device, he gives the reader an enhanced feeling for the significance of individual and social virtues espoused by the humanitarian pacifists. Paradox is often thought of as a standard device of Taoist psychology, used across imperceptible barriers of awareness. Perhaps the paradox of the art of war is in its opposition to war. And as the art of war wars against war, it does so by its own principles. It infiltrates the enemy's lines, uncovers the enemy's secrets, and changes the hearts of the enemy's troops. The commentary in this translation has been selected from a standard collection of 11 interpreters who lived from the 2nd to the 12th centuries CE. Chapter 1. Strategic Assessments. Military action is important to the nation. It is the ground of death and life, the path of survival and destruction, so it is imperative to examine it. The ground means the location, the place of pitched battle. Gain the advantage and you live. Lose the advantage and you die. Therefore, military action is called the ground of death and life. The path means the way to adjust to the situation and establish victory. Find this and you survive. Lose this and you perish. Therefore, measure in terms of five things. Use these assessments to make comparisons, and thus find out what the conditions are. The five things are the way, the weather, the terrain, the leadership, and discipline. These are to be assessed at headquarters. First, assess yourself and your opponent in terms of these five things, deciding who is superior. Then you can determine who is likely to prevail. The way means inducing people to have the same aim as the leadership, so that they will share death and share life without fear of danger. The way means humaneness and justice. In ancient times, a famous minister of state asked a political philosopher about military matters. The philosopher said, "Humaneness and justice are the means by which to govern properly. When government is carried out properly, people feel close to the leadership and think little of dying for it." The weather means the seasons. In ancient times, many soldiers lost their fingers to frostbite on campaigns against the Huns, and many soldiers died of plague on campaigns against the southern tribes. This was because of carrying out operations in winter or summer. The terrain is to be assessed in terms of distance, difficulty, or ease of travel, dimension, and safety. In any military operation, it is important first to know the lay of the land. When you know the distance to be traveled, then you can plan whether to proceed directly or by a circuitous route. When you know the difficulty or ease of travel, then you can determine the advantages of infantry or mounted troops. When you know the dimensions of the area, then you can assess how many troops you need, many or few. When you know the relative safety of the terrain, then you can discern whether to do battle or disperse. Leadership is a matter of intelligence, trustworthiness, humaneness, courage, and sternness. The way of the ancient kings was to consider humaneness foremost, while the martial artists considered intelligence foremost. This is because intelligence involves ability to plan, and to know when to change effectively. Trustworthiness means to make people sure of punishment or reward. Humaneness means love and compassion for people, being aware of their toils. Courage means to seize opportunities to make certain of victory, without vacillation. Sternness means to establish discipline in the ranks by strict punishments. Discipline means organization, chain of command, and logistics. Organization means that the troops must be grouped in a regulated manner. Chain of command means that there must be officers to keep the troops together and lead them. Logistics means overseeing supplies. Every general has heard of these five things. Those who know them prevail. Those who do not know them do not prevail. Therefore, use these assessments for comparison to find out what the conditions are. That is to say, which political leadership has the way? Which general has ability? Who has the better climate and terrain? Whose discipline is effective? Whose troops are stronger? Whose officers and soldiers are the better trained? Whose system of rewards and punishments is clearer? This is how you can know who will win. The ancient classic of documents says, "The one who treats me well is my leader. The one who treats me cruelly is my enemy." The question is, which side has a humane government, and which side has a cruel government? Assess the advantages in taking advice, then structure your forces accordingly to supplement extraordinary tactics. Forces are to be structured strategically, based on what is advantageous. A military operation involves deception. Even though you are competent, appear to be incompetent. Though effective, appear to be ineffective. This means that when you are really competent and effective, you outwardly appear to be incompetent and ineffective, so as to cause the enemy to be unprepared. Deception is for the purpose of seeking victory over an enemy. To command a group requires truthfulness. When you are going to attack nearby, make it look as if you are going to go a long way. When you are going to attack far away, make it look as if you are going just a short distance. Draw them in with the prospect of gain. Take them by confusion. When the states of Wu and Yue were at war with each other, Wu sent out 3,000 criminals to give an appearance of disorder so as to lure Yue. Some of the criminals ran. Some of them gave up. The Yue army fought with them, only to be defeated by the army of Wu. When they are fulfilled, be prepared against them. When they are strong, avoid them. If the enemy's government is fulfilled, meaning that there is mutual love between the rulers and the ruled, there is clarity and trustworthiness in the system of rewards and punishments, and the soldiers are well trained, then you should be on guard against them. Do not wait for a clash to make your preparations. Use anger to throw them into disarray. When their military leadership is obstreperous, you should irritate them to make them angry. Then they will become impetuous and ignore their original strategy. Use humility to make them haughty. Tire them by flight. Cause division among them. Attack when they are unprepared. Make your move when they do not expect it. Strike at their gaps. Attack when they are lax. Don't let the enemy figure out how to prepare. This is why it is said that in military operations, formlessness is the most effective. One of the great warrior leaders said, "The most efficient of movements is the one that is unexpected. The best of plans is the one that is unknown." The formation and procedure used by the military should not be divulged beforehand. To divulge means to leak out. The military has no constant form, just as water has no constant shape. Adapt as you face the enemy, without letting them know beforehand what you are going to do. Therefore, assessment of the enemy is in the mind. Observation of the situation is in the eyes. The one who figures on victory at headquarters, before even doing battle, is the one who has the most strategic factors on his side. The one who figures on inability to prevail at headquarters before doing battle is the one who has the least strategic factors on his side. The one with many strategic factors in his favor wins. The one with few strategic factors in his favor loses. How much the more so for one with no strategic factors in his favor? Observing the matter in this way, I can see who will win and who will lose. When your strategy is deep and far-reaching, then what you gain by your calculations is much, so you can win before you even fight. When your strategic thinking is shallow and nearsighted, then what you gain by your calculations is little, so you lose before you do battle. Therefore, it is said that victorious warriors win first and then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first and then seek to win. Chapter 2. Doing Battle. When you do battle, even if you are winning, if you continue for a long time, it will dull your forces and blunt your edge. If you besiege a citadel, your strength will be exhausted. If you keep your armies out in the field for a long time, your supplies will be insufficient. Arms are tools of ill omen. To employ them for an extended period of time will bring about calamity. As it is said, those who like to fight and so exhaust their military inevitably perish. When your forces are dulled, your edge is blunted, your strength is exhausted, and your supplies are gone, then others will take advantage of your debility and rise up. Then, even if you have wise advisors, you cannot make things turn out well in the end. Therefore, I have heard of military operations that were clumsy but swift, but I have never seen one that was skillful and lasted a long time. It has never been beneficial to a nation to have a military operation continue for a long time. As it is said, be swift as the thunder that peals before you have a chance to cover your ears, fast as the lightning that flashes before you can blink your eyes. Therefore, those who are not thoroughly aware of the disadvantages in the use of arms cannot be thoroughly aware of the advantages in the use of arms. Those who use the military skillfully do not raise troops twice and do not provide food three times. This means you draft people into service once and then immediately seize victory. You do not go back to your country a second time to raise more troops. At first, you provide food. After that, you feed off the enemy. By taking equipment from your own country, but feeding off the enemy, you can be sufficient in both arms and provisions. When a country is impoverished by military operations, it is because of transporting supplies to a distant place. Transport supplies to a distant place, and the populace will be impoverished. Those who are near the army sell at high prices. Because of high prices, the wealth of the common people is exhausted. When supplies are transported far away, the people are worn out by the expense. In the markets near the army, the prices of goods shoot up. Therefore, long military campaigns are a plague to a nation. When resources are exhausted, then levies are made under pressure. When power and resources are exhausted, then the homeland is drained. The common people are deprived of 70% of their budget, while the government's expenses for equipment amount to 60% of its budget. The people are the basis of a country. Food is the heaven of the people. Those who rule over others should respect this and be sparing. Therefore, a wise general strives to feed off the enemy. Each pound of food taken from the enemy is equivalent to 20 pounds you provide by yourself. It takes 20 pounds of provisions to deliver 1 pound of provisions to a distant army. So what kills the enemy is anger. What gets the enemy's goods is reward. If you reward your men with spoils, that will make them fight on their own initiative, so the enemy's goods can be taken. That is why it is said that where there are big rewards, there are valiant men. Therefore, in a chariot battle, reward the first to capture at least 10 chariots. If you reward everyone, there will not be enough to go around. So, you offer a reward to one in order to encourage everyone. Change their colors. Use them mixed in with your own. Treat the soldiers well. Take care of them. Captured soldiers should be well treated to get them to work for you. This is called overcoming the opponent and increasing your strength to boot. If you use the enemy to defeat the enemy, you will be strong wherever you go. So the important thing in a military operation is victory, not persistence. Persistence is not profitable. An army is like fire. If you don't put it out, it will burn itself out. Hence, we know that the leader of the army is in charge of the lives of the people and safety of the nation. This tells us how serious the matter of appointing military leaders is. Chapter 3. Planning a Siege. The general rule for use of the military is that it is better to keep a nation intact than to destroy it. It is better to keep an army intact than to destroy it. Better to keep a division intact than to destroy it. Better to keep a battalion intact than to destroy it. Better to keep a unit intact than to destroy it. Wei Liaotzu said, "Practicing martial arts, assess your opponents. Cause them to lose spirit and direction so that even if the opposing army is intact, it is useless. This is winning by the Tao. If you destroy the opposing army and kill the generals, mount the ramparts shooting, gather a mob and usurp the land, this is winning by force. Therefore, those who win every battle are not really skillful. Those who render others' armies helpless without fighting are the best of all. The superior militarist strikes while schemes are being laid. The next best is to attack alliances. The next best is to attack the army. To be good at successful attack, deploying your forces without a hitch, is yet another notch down. Therefore, a great warrior emperor said, "One who fights for victory in front of bared blades is not a good general." The lowest is to attack a city. Siege of a city is only done as a last resort. Take 3 months to prepare your machines and 3 months to complete your siege engineering. Some say that Master Sun's point here is that you shouldn't get angry and rush to attack. This is why he says to take time. If the general cannot overcome his anger and has his army swarm over the citadel, killing a third of his soldiers, and yet the citadel is still not taken, this is a disastrous attack. Therefore, one who is good at martial arts overcomes others' forces without battle, conquers other cities without siege, destroys others' nations without taking a long time. A skillful martialist ruins plans, spoils relations, cuts off supplies, or blocks the way, and hence can overcome people without fighting. It is imperative to contest all factions for complete victory, so the army is not garrisoned and the profit can be total. This is the law of strategic siege. Complete victory is when the army does not fight, the city is not besieged, the destruction does not go on long, but in each case the enemy is overcome by strategy. So the rule for use of the military is that if you outnumber the opponent 10-1, then surround them. 5-1, attack. 2-1, divide. If you are equal, then fight if you are able. If you are fewer, then keep away if you are able. If you are not as good, then flee if you are able. This advice applies to the case where all else is equal. If your forces are orderly while theirs are chaotic, if you are excited and they are sluggish, then even if they are more numerous, you can do battle. If your soldiers' strength, strategy, and courage are all less than that of the opponent, then you should retreat and watch for an opening. Therefore, if the smaller side is stubborn, it becomes the captive of the larger side. This means that if a small country does not assess its power and dares to become the enemy of a large country, no matter how firm its defenses be, it will inevitably become a captive nation. The spring and autumn annals say, "If you cannot be strong and yet cannot be weak, this will result in your defeat." Generals are assistants of the nation. When their assistance is complete, the country is strong. When their assistance is defective, the country is weak. If the generals do not help the leadership and harbor duplicity in their hearts, then the country will be weak. Therefore, it is imperative to be careful in choosing people for positions of responsibility. So there are three ways in which a civil leadership causes the military trouble. When a civil leadership, unaware of the facts, tells its armies to advance when they should not, or tells its armies to retreat when they should not, this is called tying up the armies. When the civil leadership is ignorant of military affairs, but shares equally in the government of the armies, the soldiers get confused. When the civil leadership is ignorant of military maneuvers, but shares equally in the command of the armies, the soldiers hesitate. Once the armies are confused and hesitant, trouble comes from competitors. This is called taking away victory by deranging the military. If you try to use the methods of civilian government to govern a military operation, the operation will become confused. So there are five ways of knowing who will win. Those who know when to fight and when not to fight are victorious. Those who discern when to use many or few troops are victorious. Those whose upper and lower ranks have the same desire are victorious. Those who face the unprepared with preparation are victorious. Those whose generals are able and are not constrained by their governments are victorious. These five are the ways to know who will win. To talk about government orders for all this is like going to announce to your superiors that you want to put out a fire. By the time you get back with an order, there is nothing left but ashes. So it is said that if you know others and know yourself, you will not be imperiled in 100 battles. If you do not know others but know yourself, you win one and lose one. If you do not know others and do not know yourself, you will be imperiled in every single battle. Chapter 4. Formation. In ancient times, skillful warriors first made themselves invincible and then watched for vulnerability in their opponents. Making yourself invincible means knowing yourself. Waiting for vulnerability in opponents means knowing others. Invincibility is in oneself. Vulnerability is in the opponent. Therefore, skillful warriors are able to be invincible, but they cannot cause opponents to be vulnerable. If opponents have no formation to find out, no gap or slack to take advantage of, how can you overcome them even if you are well equipped? That is why it is said that victory can be discerned, but not manufactured. Invincibility is a matter of defense. Vulnerability is a matter of attack. As long as you have not seen vulnerable formations in opponents, you hide your own form, preparing yourself in such a way as to be invincible in order to preserve yourself. When opponents have vulnerable formations, then it is time to go out and attack them. Defense is for times of insufficiency. Attack is for times of surplus. Those skilled in defense hide in the deepest depths of the earth. though skilled in attack, maneuver in the highest heights of the sky. Therefore they can preserve themselves and achieve complete victory. In defense, you hush your voices and obliterate your tracks, hidden as ghosts and spirits beneath the earth, invisible to anyone. On the attack, your movement is swift and your cry shattering, fast as thunder and lightning, as though coming from the sky, impossible to prepare for. To perceive victory when it is known to all is not really skillful. Everyone calls victory in battle good, but it is not really good. Everyone says victory in battle is good, but if you see the subtle and notice the hidden so as to seize victory where there is no form, this is really good. It does not take much strength to lift a hair. It does not take sharp eyes to see the sun and moon. It does not take sharp ears to hear a thunderclap. What everyone knows is not called wisdom. Victory over others by forced battle is not considered good. In ancient times, those known as good warriors prevailed when it was easy to prevail. If you are only able to ensure victory after engaging an opponent in armed conflict, that victory is a hard one. If you see the subtle and notice the hidden, breaking through before formation, that victory is an easy one. Therefore, the victories of good warriors are not noted for cleverness or bravery. Therefore, their victories in battle are not flukes. Their victories are not flukes because they position themselves where they will surely win, prevailing over those who have already lost. Great wisdom is not obvious. Great merit is not advertised. When you see the subtle, it is easy to win. What has it to do with bravery or cleverness? When trouble is solved before it forms, who calls that clever? When there is victory without battle, who talks about bravery? So it is that good warriors take their stand on ground where they cannot lose, and do not overlook conditions that make an opponent prone to defeat. Therefore, a victorious army wins first, and then seeks battle. A defeated army first battles, and then seeks victory. This is the difference between those with strategy and those without forethought. Those who use arms well cultivate the way and keep the rules. Thus they can govern in such a way as to prevail over the corrupt. Using harmony to hunt down opposition, not attacking a blameless country, not taking captives or booty wherever the army goes, not raising the trees or polluting the wells, washing off and purifying the shrines of the towns and hills in the countryside you pass through, not repeating the mistakes of a moribund nation. All this is called the way and its rules. When the army is strictly disciplined to the point where soldiers would rather die than disobey, rewards and punishments that are trustworthy and are just are established, when the military leadership is such that it can achieve this, it can prevail over an opponent's corrupt civil government. The rules of the military are five: measurement, assessment, calculation, comparison, and victory. The ground gives rise to measurements. Measurements give rise to assessments. Assessments give rise to calculations. Calculations give rise to comparisons. Comparisons give rise to victories. By the comparisons of measurements, you know where victory and defeat lie. Therefore, a victorious army is like a pound compared to a gram. A defeated army is like a gram compared to a pound. When the victorious get their people to go to battle, as if they were directing a massive flood of water into a deep canyon, this is a matter of formation. When water accumulates in a deep canyon, no one can measure its amount, just as our defense shows no form. When the water is released, it rushes down in a torrent, just as our attack is irresistible. Chapter 5. Force. Governing a large number, as though governing a small number, is a matter of division into groups. Battling a large number, as though battling a small number, is a matter of forms and calls. Forms and calls refer to the formations and signals used to dispose troops and coordinate movements. Making the armies able to take on opponents without being defeated is a matter of unorthodox and orthodox methods. Orthodoxy and unorthodoxy are not fixed, but are like a cycle. Emperor Taizong of the Tang Dynasty, a famous warrior and administrator, spoke of manipulating opponents' perceptions of what is orthodox and what is unorthodox, then attacking unexpectedly, combining both into one, becoming inscrutable to opponents. For the impact of armed forces to be like stones thrown on eggs is a matter of emptiness and fullness. When you induce opponents to come to you, then their force is always empty. As long as you do not go to them, your force is always full. Attacking emptiness with fullness is like throwing stones on eggs. The eggs are sure to break. In battle, confrontation is done directly. Victory is gained by surprise. Therefore, those skilled at the unorthodox are infinite as heaven and earth, inexhaustible as the great rivers. When they come to an end, they begin again, like the days and months. They die and are reborn, like the four seasons. Sun and moon travel through the sky. They set and rise again. The four seasons succeed one another, flourishing and then fading again. This is a metaphor for the interchange of surprise, unorthodox movements, and orthodox direct confrontation, mixing together into a whole, ending and beginning infinitely. There are only five notes in the musical scale, but their variations are so many that they cannot all be heard. There are only five basic colors, but their variations are so many that they cannot all be seen. There are only five basic flavors, but their variations are so many that they cannot all be tasted. There are only two kinds of charge in battle, the unorthodox surprise attack and the orthodox direct attack. But variations of the unorthodox and the orthodox are endless. The unorthodox and the orthodox give rise to each other, like a beginningless cycle. Who could exhaust them? When the speed of rushing water reaches the point where it can move boulders, this is the force of momentum. When the speed of a hawk is such that it can strike and kill, this is precision. So it is with skillful warriors. Their force is swift. Their precision is close. Their force is like drawing a catapult. Their precision is like releasing the trigger. Their force is swift in the sense that the force of the momentum of battle kills when it is released. That is why it is likened to a drawn catapult. Disorder arises from order. Cowardice arises from courage. Weakness arises from strength. What this means is that if you want to feign disorder so as to lead opponents on, first you must have complete order, for only then can you create artificial disorder. If you want to feign cowardice to spy on opponents, first you must be extremely brave, for only then can you act artificially timid. If you want to feign weakness to induce haughtiness in opponents, first you must be extremely strong, for only then can you pretend to be weak. Order and disorder are a matter of organization. Courage and cowardice are a matter of momentum. Strength and weakness are a matter of formation. When an army has the force of momentum, even the timid become brave. When it loses the force of momentum, Even the brave become timid. Nothing is fixed in the laws of warfare. They develop based on momentum. Therefore, those who skillfully move opponents make formations that opponents are sure to follow, give what opponents are sure to take. They move opponents with the prospect of gain, waiting for them in ambush. Formations that opponents are sure to follow are formations that give the impression of exhaustion. Opponents are moved by the prospect of an advantage. Therefore, good warriors seek effectiveness in battle from the force of momentum, not from individual people. Therefore, they are able to choose people and let the force of momentum do its work. When you have the force of momentum in war, even the timid can be courageous. So it is possible to choose them for the capabilities and give them the appropriate responsibilities. The brave can fight, the careful can guard, the intelligent can communicate. No one is useless. Getting people to fight by letting the force of momentum work is like rolling logs and rocks. Logs and rocks are still when in a secure place, but roll on an incline. They remain stationary if square. They roll if round. Therefore, when people are skillfully led into battle, the momentum is like that of round rocks rolling down a high mountain. This is force. Roll rocks down a 10,000-foot mountain, and they cannot be stopped. This is because of the mountain, not the rocks. Get people to fight with the courage to win every time, and the strong and the weak unite. This is because of the momentum, not the individuals. Chapter 6. Emptiness and Fullness. Those who are first on the battlefield and await the opponents are at ease. Those who are last on the battlefield and head into battle get worn out. Therefore, good warriors cause others to come to them and do not go to others. If you make opponents come to fight, then their force will always be empty. If you do not go to fight, then your force will always be full. This is the art of emptying others and filling yourself. What causes opponents to come of their own accord is the prospect of gain. What discourages opponents from coming is the prospect of harm. So when opponents are at ease, it is possible to tire them. When they are well fed, it is possible to starve them. When they are at rest, it is possible to move them. You attack unexpectedly, causing opponents to become exhausted just running for their lives. You burn their supplies and raise their fields, cutting off their supply routes. You appear at critical places and strike when they least expect it, making them have to go to the rescue. Appear where they cannot go. Head for where they least expect you. To travel hundreds of miles without fatigue, go over land where there are no people. Striking at an open gap does not only mean where the opponent has no defense. As long as the defense is not strict, the place is not tightly guarded, they will fall apart in front of you, as if you were traveling over unpopulated territory. To unfailingly take what you attack, attack where there is no defense. For unfailingly secure defense, defend where there is no attack. So in the case of those who are skilled in attack, their opponents do not know where to defend. In the case of those skilled in defense, their opponents do not know where to attack. When directives are carried out, people are sincerely loyal, preparations for defense are firmly secured, and yet you are so subtle and secretive that you reveal no form. Opponents are unsure. Their intelligence is of no avail. Be extremely subtle, even to the point of formlessness. Be extremely mysterious, even to the point of soundlessness. Thereby you can be the director of the opponent's fate. to advance irresistibly, push through their gaps. To retreat elusively, outspeed them. Military conditions are based on speed. Come like the wind, go like lightning, and opponents will be unable to overcome you. Therefore, when you want to do battle, even if the opponent is deeply entrenched in a defensive position, he will be unable to avoid fighting if you attack where he will surely go to the rescue. When you do not want to do battle, even if you draw a line on the ground to hold, the opponent cannot fight with you because you set him off on the wrong track. This means that when opponents come to attack you, you do not fight with them but rather set up a strategic change to confuse them and make them uncertain. Therefore, when you induce others to construct a formation while you yourself are formless, then you are concentrated while the opponent is divided. What is orthodox to you, make opponents see as unorthodox. What is unorthodox to you, make them see as orthodox. This is inducing others to construct a formation. Once the opponent's formation is seen, you then mash your troops against it. Since your form is not revealed, the opponent will surely divide up his forces for security. When you are concentrated into one, while the opponent is divided into 10, you are attacking at a concentration of 10-1, so you outnumber the opponent. If you can strike few with many, you will thus minimize the number of those with whom you do battle. While being deeply entrenched and highly barricaded, not allowing any information about yourself to become known, go out and in formlessly, attacking and taking unfathomably. Your battleground is not to be known, for when it cannot be known, the enemy makes many guard outposts. And since multiple outposts are established, you only have to do battle with small squads. So when the front is prepared, the rear is lacking, and when the rear is prepared, the front is lacking. Preparedness on the left means lack on the right. Preparedness on the right means lack on the left. Preparedness everywhere means lack everywhere. This means that when troops are on guard in many places, they are perforce scattered into small bands. The few are those on the defensive against others. The many are those who cause others to be on the defensive against themselves. The more defenses you induce your enemy to adopt, the more impoverished your enemy will be. So if you know the place and time of battle, you can join the fight from 1,000 miles away. If you do not know the place and time of battle, then your left flank cannot save your right. Your right cannot save your left. Your vanguard cannot save your rear guard. And your rear guard cannot save your vanguard, even in the short range of a few to a few dozen miles. According to my assessment, even if you have many more troops than others, how can that help you to victory? If you don't know the place and time of battle, even though your troops outnumber others, how can you know whether you will win or lose? So it is said that victory can be made. If you cause opponents to be unaware of the place and time of battle, you can always win. Even if opponents are numerous, they can be made not to fight. So assess them to find out their plans, both the successful ones and the failures. Incite them to action in order to find out the patterns of their movement and rest. Do something for or against them, making opponents turn their attention to it, so that you can find out their patterns of aggressive and defensive behavior. Induce them to adopt specific formations in order to know the ground of death and life. This means that you use many methods to confuse and disturb enemies to observe the forms of their response to you. After that, you deal with them accordingly, so you can know what sort of situations mean life and what sort of situations mean death. Test them to find out where they are sufficient and where they are lacking. Therefore, the consummation of forming an army is to arrive at formlessness. When you have no form, undercover espionage cannot find out anything. Intelligence cannot form a strategy.
Once you have no perceptible form, you leave no traces to follow, so spies cannot find any chinks to see through, and those in charge of intelligence cannot put any plans into operation.
Victory over multitudes by means of formation is unknowable to the multitudes. Everyone knows the form by which I am victorious, but no one knows the form by which I ensure victory. Therefore, victory in war is not repetitious, but adapts its form endlessly. Determining changes as appropriate, do not repeat former strategies to gain victory. Whatever formations opponents may adopt, from the beginning I can adapt to them to attain victory. Military formation is like water. The form of water is to avoid the high and go to the low. The form of a military force is to avoid the full and attack the empty. The flow of water is determined by the earth. The victory of a military force is determined by the opponent. So a military force has no constant formation. Water has no constant shape. The ability to gain victory by changing and adapting according to the opponent is called genius. How can you ensure victory if not on the basis of the enemy's own posture? A light brigade cannot hold out long, so if you keep it under siege, it will inevitably lose. A heavy brigade will unfailingly respond to a provocation and expose itself. If the opposing army is angry, shame it. If the army is strong, get it to relax. If the opposing general is proud, humiliate him. If the general is greedy, bait him. If the general is suspicious, spy on him right back. Therefore, the manner of victory is determined according to the enemy.
Chapter 7. Armed Struggle.
The ordinary rule for use of military force is for the military command to receive the orders from the civilian authorities, then to gather and mass the troops, quartering them together. Nothing is harder than armed struggle. To fight with people face to face over advantages is the hardest thing in the world. The difficulty of armed struggle is to make long distances near and make problems into advantages. While giving the appearance of being far away, you can step up your pace and get there before the opponent. Therefore, make your route a long one, luring them on in hopes of gain. When you set out after others and arrive before them, you know the strategy of making the distant near. You use a special squad to lure the opponent on a wild goose chase, making it seem as though your main force is far away. Then you send out a surprise attack force that gets there first, even though it sets out last. Therefore, armed struggle is considered profitable, and armed struggle is considered dangerous. For the skilled, it is profitable. For the unskilled, it is dangerous. To mobilize the whole army to struggle for advantage would take too long. Yet to struggle for advantage with a stripped-down army results in a lack of equipment. So if you travel light, not stopping day or night, doubling your usual pace, struggling for an advantage 100 miles away, your military leaders will be captured. Strong soldiers will get there first, the weary later on. As a rule, 1 in 10 make it. When the road is long, the people are weary. If their strength has been used up in travel, then they are worn out while their opponents are fresh, so they are sure to be attacked. Struggling for an advantage 50 miles away will thwart the forward leadership, and as a rule, only 50% of the soldiers make it. struggle for an advantage 30 miles away, and 2 out of 3 get there. So an army perishes if it has no equipment. It perishes if it has no food, and it perishes if it has no money. These 3 things are necessary. You cannot fight to win with an unequipped army. So if you do not know the plans of your competitors, you cannot make informed alliances. Unless you know the mountains and forests, the defiles and impasses, and the lay of the marshes and swamps, you cannot maneuver with an armed force. Unless you use local guides, you cannot get the advantages of the land. Only when you know every detail of the lay of the land can you maneuver and contend. So a military force is established by deception, mobilized by gain, and adapted by division and combination. A military force is established by deception in the sense that you deceive enemies so that they do not know your real condition, and then can establish supremacy. It is mobilized by gain in the sense that it goes into action when it sees an advantage. Dividing and recombining is done to confuse opponents and observe how they react to you, so that then you can adapt in such a way as to seize victory. Therefore, when it moves swiftly, it is like the wind. When it goes slowly, it is like a forest. It is rapacious as fire, immovable as mountains. It is swift as the wind in that it comes without a trace and withdraws like lightning. It is like a forest in that it is orderly. It is rapacious as fire across a plain, not leaving a single blade of grass. It is immovable as a mountain when it garrisons. It is as hard to know as the dark. Its movement is like pealing thunder. To plunder a locality, divide up your troops. To expand your territory, divide the spoils. The rule for military operations is to feed off the enemy as much as possible. However,